This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Intik. One of the first conflicts of the Cold War, the Malayan Emergency, was a guerrilla war fought between the Commonwealth Armed Forces and communist insurgents from 1948 to 1960. My guest today is Dr. Su Cho Yeo, who has written a collection of essays looking at the emergency through the lives and struggles of ordinary men and women in colonial Malaya. Dr. Yeo, why did you want to revisit the emergency? Why write this book now?
I've been working many years in overseas, Singapore and Sydney. The longest time I spent is in Sydney. Although I grew up in Malaysia, and I really didn't write anything on Malaysia. Malaysia is surprisingly a difficult place to write about, mainly because many of the subjects have been covered quite extensively. So when you write about Malaysia, you find that you're writing footnote for everybody. You know, you don't want to kind of revisit the ground again. So I kind of stew on it in my mind for many years, thinking about how can I write a book about Malaysia? And I thought at the end, I decided on writing Malay Emergency because Malay Emergency has so many kind of myths about it. We all grew up with the myth about British generosity and handing us a rich, wealthy country for democracy and the judicial system, the whole lot. And I thought, okay, this is a good start. I think it's a good start because so much of our life now in 2016, it is a legacy of all those measures, what they call emergency measures, the ISAF most famously, although it's been, you know, repeal, but you know what the consequences are. And so that's really one of the reasons. So in a sense, the book is a book of my coming home, if you like. Yeah.
When did this project start?
I started this project for about 3 years. Basically, when I was teaching, I didn't have time to finish it, but I spent a lot of time. Every holiday, I went up to southern Thailand. As you know, southern Thailand, north of Malaysia, the ex-guerrillas of the MCP, Malaysian and Malayan Communist Party, have settled there in about 4 or 5. So it's a kind of quite convenient for anthropologists. You know, this is my tribal people. That's my tribe. So I went and spent time with my tribe, hanging out with them and talk to them. So I really started to write when I sort of started working part-time in Sydney, spent quite a bit of time in Port Dickson. So this is my first Malaysian book in that sense, yeah.
You mentioned a little bit about how you wanted to examine this myth that all of us were taught in schools. But when did you know that they were myth? Was there a tipping point where you realized, I have to do something about this?
Well, if you ask me about when is the particular tipping point, I can remember distinctively that day, the time, that afternoon, the Adelaide Film Festival. Adelaide is a place where I studied for many years. Adelaide Film Festival showed this incredible film called The Battle of Algiers by an Italian film director called Pocho Contove. And he described, you know, almost scientifically, if you like, Marxism is what I call a scientist study of revolution. He made this film about, I was very stunned. I was like 20 years old. You know, I left Malaysia 2 years ago. I mean, here was the one who really showed, not so much to demonize, not so much say that colonialism is a bad person. I mean, we know they're bad, but to show that it's a way to approach revolution in an intellectual, scientific way. The emotional side, we all get swept away, you know, by all this. So in a way, that was in 1972. So it's a long time ago, but I find that I was very moved. So I feel there is a new way to look at the whole thing. And also, I suppose, I mean, that's one thing. But, of course, you know, once the lucky thing about leaving Malaysia, you left all those horrible and good and bad influences people put in your head about our nation or our parents or whatever. So I was living very much alone in that sense, because all my normal influences were gone. I mean, where are my parents, all those things. And I started reading very widely. So I lost Malaysia for many, many years. I lost them. And my specialization in university life over the year was Marxism, because Marxism is a theory that gives you quite an insight about political life, our political life. And also, so when I start looking at, I went to do a PhD in Hong Kong about the colonial system. So I have a lot of rethinking and rethinking all the time about this problem of political life and revolution. So the whole idea why that the British have to fight, in what method they use, and also how the NCP responded to the emergency measure is something, in a way, I knew about a lot, because once you watch Battle of Algiers, once you knew something about what French were doing in Algeria, what Americans were doing. Let's not forget, American had a colony in Southeast Asia, which was the Philippines. So their counterinsurgency measure was classic. It's very much what British did. So in a sense, from those reading, I realized Malaya emergency is not a Malayan war as such. It's an imperial colonial war fought within certain kind of strategy.
Am I right in saying you are trained as an anthropologist?
Yes.
What did you want to add to our understanding of the emergency through the anthropological lens?
Anthropology is a funny kind of discipline. I was drawn to it. I did my first degree in economics, like all nice Malaysian boys, you know, girls did or do. And, you know, so after I came back to Malaysia for a year and I wasn't very happy, I was get a job in one of the big bank, which should probably be nameless in this program. And I thought, I got to go and find myself. So I discovered anthropology, because two things that attracts me to anthropology. First of all, anthropology is a very empirical science. Doesn't encourage you to stay in your house, in your office. Like, we always have a joke that, oh, your boots are so clean for 6 months. You know, you should go out in the jungle. You should go out to mix, get your boots dirty, as the English would say. So I was very attracted to that. And so I went to Hong Kong and stayed in the fishing village for a year. And I went to 7th Division in Sarawak. I spent a few months there. And this time, I spent a lot of time in southern Thailand. So the groundedness, I have to kind of take off my shirt and tie and get there to get my boots dirty. That attracts me a lot. I'm still very committed to this way of doing research. And the other one is, the other aspect of anthropology is almost the opposite. You know, after you get all this data, you get all these 200 people live in the village, they do this, they, you know, once in 3 years they do this kind of ritual. What is significant of this? What do you make of it? You've got to draw the significance and guide the reader, because you say there are 650 people in this village, and 3 years ago there were 200. That fact means nothing, but it's how you make of it, what argument you're going to make of it, what's significant about human life that you are going to make of these facts. That's important. So anthropology has always been kind of schizophrenic in this way. On one hand, you want to be empirical. One hand, you get up to the kind of cloud and deal with a certain kind of theory. So as you know, I'm very committed to Freud and Marxism precisely for those things.
When I come to the book now, you wrote that it is a book that is peppered with a sense of futility. Can you elaborate on that?
It is a futility because, you know, we are too, it's a funny book to write about 2016, you know, to 2016. It's a long time, you know, it's a long time where. And the other reason why I emphasize the futility aspect of that is because I let many young people, and I read The Star, and I read all these newspaper cuttings, and there's a lot of talk about these are the Merdeka hero that we have forgotten. There's a sense of nostalgia about it, because there's nothing more romantic, nothing more inducive of a nostalgia than a failed revolution. You know, a failed revolution is like cutting your youth short. You know, the beautiful young, like James Dean is a good character, you know. So you feel this beautiful dream has been cut short. Everyone feels nostalgia about a communist. Now, of course, I'm probably, you might call myself a leftist scholar in the sense I'm more pro-communist than non-communist. But after, I won't say, 1989, the end of before the Berlin Wall, much earlier than in 1930s, Stalin has started killing people. A lot of intellectuals can't handle the fact that these are supposed to be good guys, which is the Soviet Union. How could they massacre so many people? And let's be very frank, Mao Zedong's China killed more people than the Nazi did on the Jews, and Cambodia is just around the corner from us. So the sense of futility is, in a sense, a futility about history, futility about how politics, I'm just my own personal kind of philosophic cynicism, if you like. Unfortunately, revolution always end up failing you, left, right, and center. I mean, that's so, and so, especially in southern Thailand, and these are a group of people who always said to me, I have not wasted my youth in the jungle. I haven't even started raising the question. You know, this is very Freudian, if you like. You know, the return of the repressed, the things they are not said came out from the word to say themselves. So they are going to their mind, I have wasted my life. You know, especially women who spend their 20s and 30s in the jungle, so they miss their childbearing age. And young men, when they went to the jungle and very young, when they came out from the jungle and the peace agreement was signed in 1989, the whole world for them is gone. There's a whole sense of lost life for them. So, of course, they have incredible psychological need to revisit those great event of which they were a part. So the futility came out from almost like this kind of anxious overreaction that they have not wasted a life, in fact, when they have. You know. So I feel very much of that because to write about revolution now, it sounds like I'm being nostalgic about it. So my book is a very difficult book for me to write because I have to re-examine my position. You know, why do you support the Communist Party and not the British? What is the motivation for doing that? Are you being fashionable or are you being whatever the case may be? Well, anyhow, it's all in my book about my own internal conflict.
My guest today is Dr. Su Cho Yao. He's the author of a new collection of essays called The Malayan Emergency, Essays on a Small Distant War. We'll talk more about his trip to southern Thailand after the break. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Eun Teik. My guest today is Dr. Su Cho Yao. He is the author of The Malayan Emergency, Essays on a Small Distant War. You can get it from Gerak Budaya. Dr. Yao, you were talking about the allure, the attractiveness of communism and the ideological battle going on in the 40s, 50s and 60s. At the time, how much support did the MCP have among Malayans?
I think all this talk about futility and disillusionment is really, we are talking about the current reassessment of the past. In a way, it's terribly unfair because things must always look at within its context. Now, so you may say these young women in their 18s or 20s, you know, getting all excited about revolution, but revolution in the 1950s was the communist revolution, particularly was anti-colonial revolution of any kind. In 1950, was a huge thing. It's like the greatest, you know, pop music in the world or whatever. You know, young people were drawn. When I say young people, certain kind of young people. I think in Malaysia there is a kind of class divide that, you know, those who went to Chinese schools, which, of course, I did that. I went to Confucius Middle School. And so the Chinese school environment, because the class situation, they're more likely to be children of rickshaw driver, children of hawkers, children of very poor people. And they are kind of modernity, you know, that sense of being modern, being progressive. It's communism. Now, of course, in Malaysia, we are not allowed to talk about communism. So the communism is too obvious a term. So this idea of communism, this is another way we are talking about modernity, is being slightly disguised so into what we call progressive literature. You know, so the newspaper will have, I had a chapter on that, the newspaper will have, you know, a short story or a small novella. We will talk about a rickshaw driver. Now, usually rickshaw driver's point of view to write a short story is already revolutionary, you know. I mean, this will not happen in the short story of Malaya written by, you know, whoever it was. And the English-speaking world is very different. I remember my friends, because Confucius Middle School right next to Methodist Boys' School. So we were going downhill carrying our, Chinese novel or Ba Jing or Hong Lou Moon or whatever the case may be. And they were going up to meet their pastors for the Sunday school. So their modernity expressed by Cliff Richards or Elvis Presley or whatever. So the Chinese had this sense of life that make them, from my point of view, anyway, quite special. So the communist attraction to communism is precisely that we are going to change our life, not so much the life of the world, change our individual life. And to change our individual life is not only to improve the living of my parents, because I want to open up my eyes to bigger things. What happened in Algeria? I think in Chinese school we had a kind of almost quite insidiously cosmopolitan. We knew about the Spanish Civil War to the little references in the Chinese newspaper. We knew about the Polish invasion of the Soviet Union, to the newspaper, to the article, people write poems. And then we were also influenced by Mao Zedong's writing about guerrilla warfare, how the fish is a metaphor of guerrilla. The water is the population base, or the fish cannot live without the water. So a lot of poems, right, talk about fish and water. I mean, it's nothing to do with fish and water. It's not trying to help you to set up an aquarium. It's about reference to the politicization of peasants' life. So all this is part of the universe. I think it's very important to remember that. I keep on reminding myself. So they went through the disillusionment. Fortunately, unfortunately, communism had failed for whatever reason for that. But that world was very exciting. I talked to these people, now in their 80s, talking about their young, when they were, I had this a lady, her nom de guerre, her war name is called Xiao Hong. I mean, she's 85 years old. She lives in Ampang, because after the 1989 peace accord, so she was allowed to come back and live in Malaysia. And she keep, it was a very moving spending afternoons. I've seen her many days because suddenly she's gone to the stage of being involved in that whole hothouse ideological environment. And then she went to the jungle. I mean, jungle is a nice metaphor. Malayan jungle is not a very nice place, or a canopy of darkness. And then she came out, 60s in southern Thailand. So that's how it's a kind of, pretty ironic, the whole thing. No one get what they want, and everybody get a distorted version of what they want at the end.
Yeah. When you were speaking to them, you thought that it was life wasted, but at the time when they were living through it, they thought they were part of something grandiose. They were going to change the world, revolution. Yeah. It was Malaya's only revolution at the time.
Yeah.
Do they recognize that, or is there a sense of regret or longing, or like what do they think of the world they live in today?
Well, I have to say, what's going on in southern Thailand is what the communist, the mainland China call Hong Se Li Yu. Hong Se Li Yu meaning red tourism. China, in order to promote their communist path, they turn all the guerrilla bases in China into a tourist center. There's a whole patriotic duty to spend your holiday and visit those Hong Se Li Yu spot.
Yeah, so they call this guerrilla tourism.
Yeah, guerrilla tourism. So southern Thailand is also become a guerrilla tourism, so unfortunately. So that's a kind of format. When you arrive, this uncle guerrilla will come and tell you the story about themselves. So all this disillusion, and then there are a lot of young people from Malaysia and Singapore, uncle, auntie, all that stuff. And they knew what you came here for. Then you came here to listen to the heroic story. So they are like tourism. They're providing you what you want to hear. So I listened to all that, but I knew that's not what I really wanted to write about in the end. So I do a lot of what anthropologists do. We call observation participation, the last bit. The participation of it. I tried my best to be part of their lives. So I'm not a very great drinker, but I end up drinking much more than I wanted to. And, they're off guard, and you smoke cigarette, and they start So that's why I have to write like a failed novelist. You know, many things are implied based on my, not only my observation, but also my reading of their mind. I'm entering the mind and take their point of view and write about it. So these, you may say, are not very scientific because I'm implying. They didn't say it to me, they did. But that's why a novelistic kind of technique, if you like, is important because we are not like, you know, Christopher Isherwood, like a camera. You know, you are a camera, but you're very selective what you take from those selected truths to come out and say the things you want to talk, come about. You know, all these techniques established by Flaubert, you know, Balzac, you know, has become anthropology of my generation, a way to get at the truth so that behind all the boasting, we have not wasted time. You know, there are a lot of kind of sadness in them. You know, you just got to catch them at the right moment. They're not going to tell you openly that we wasted our life, but you spend enough time with them. You are quite reasonably say or write down in words they have wasted their life from a certain point of view, you know. But nonetheless, they have great taking part in the greatest adventure in the world in the 20th century. So you can't say they wasted their life either. You know? So this kind of ambivalence of gray area is what interests me.
It seems like you are talking about guerrilla tourism in a disparaging way. But isn't it good that, I guess, young Malaysians and Singaporeans are seeking out these alternative voices, alternative histories?
Oh, certainly, certainly. I don't want to kind of pose myself as a kind of grand old professor and every young people are doing the silly things. I mean, to be there and be foolish, certainly better than not to be there and be foolish, you know. So at least you have some kind of curiosity. But that, with that curiosity, it comes with certain kind of intellectual responsibility. You know, you come back from those tours, you talk to your friends, and you want to kind of portray certain kind of truth as well. You don't want to influence your friend, let's go and have another tour and take their snapshots and selfies. That's just a little bit kind of
lazy.
Lazy, that's the best word I can, most polite word I can come up, yes.
This is a very personal book for you as well. We'll come to that in a bit. You subtitled this book, Essays on a Small Distant War. The insurgency in Malaya has been called many things, including the Small War or the Asian Cold War. It was also an undeclared war, heavy human toll as well as huge financial losses or huge financial costs on the empire. Why was it called the Small Distant War?
You know, I fought over with the editor, with the publisher. They said, you don't need that line. You know, they want me to take out the word essays, you know, like, you know, my model for this is Samuel Johnson, you know, John Addison, the English essay, Montaigne is a better example, the French essays. The essay form is very nice because you just have a burst of ideas and you step back and think and meditate or think about it. So it's not like making an argument like A to B and C. In this paper, I want to argue that the first section do this. So meditation, I'm trying to give the impression is my way, my mind, I just kind of follow my mind where it takes me on the subject. And then it's like chasing a deer in the forest, as it were, and see where it takes me. And that's the essay form. Essay form is, I think, a very powerful form because you start with some empirical situation, as I did, or having afternoon tea with the gorilla lady. And then where does it take me? At the end of my book, I talks about going to buy a linen suit from British India. You know, how did I feel? What did I wear the British when I was so anti-British? Now I'm wearing this linen suit, pretending to be an Englishman in the tropics. What are you doing? So essay format allowed me to meditate on this thing. The small little war is, I might sense, a little bit of joke, a little bit of irony, because it is small, it is distant, but it's not small in real terms. You know, there's a lot of people working. I had the figure here that in 1952, there were 40,000 British and Commonwealth troops, and then 67,000 policemen and women, and then 250,000 home guards, you know. And the cost of the whole war is £700 million. You know, there's a lot of money in those, probably I would say you're putting present currency multiplied by, 20 to get the... So it's not small, neither is distant. You know, I search for us, Malaysian reader, is not distant. And it's not distant in the sense that in 1948, there are all kinds of similar war happening all over the colonies, you know, in Kenya, in Palestine, in Cyprus. It's a whole series of anti-colonial, anti-revolutionary war at the time when British were retreating from the colonies. It's last kind of convulsion of power they want to show to maintain their power, but they know it's not possible. But of course, Malaysia is a special case, and we should talk about that in a bit later. Why was it so special?
Yeah, let's talk about that now. We came out of the Second World War jubilated that we've pushed out the Japanese, and the MCP was working with the British in fighting the Japanese. How did we go from that point to June 16, 1948, when the first shots of the emergency was fired?
Yeah. You know, it's very, very interesting you asked that question, because some of the veterans of the British Commonwealth troops, British troops, there's a colonel that I knew, and he said to me, you know, we should have collaborate with the company. We should make them part of our government. I mean, they have story about the corruption, the present government. It's just wish. I mean, he's an old man now, so, and. So the whole thing is like a miss for certain kind of people. It's like a missed opportunity, because in the Second World War, in the anti-Japanese resistance, the only effective force were the communists. You know, so the British worked with them for their own strategic reason, but part with that collaboration, because they have famous Force 136, as you know, a small team of British officers were what we now call embedded, you know, into the with the communist troops in the jungle. And so they were very close. It's a very romantic story, you know, because they're very close. They were, you know, in the, you know, if they were, you might even develop a kind of strong homoerotic attraction with this. You know, they sleep in close danger, constantly attacked. And but then after the Second World War, they become enemies, you know. So they were, especially some of the British officers were like, their job is to train, to track those his friends who saved their life, you know. So it's a kind of, I mean, that is a very romantic story. I wish I had an opportunity to write about. So what happened was that the collaboration was very important. I think culturally, culturally more than anything else, there was a small group of people. Force 136 is not more than 20, 30 people. And of course, this is one of those, you know, classic tragic story that means you want the world to remain the same when the outside world is collapsing left, right, and center. In a way, you can say, during the Second World War, it's possible to have a China, Malayan-British friendship, you know, have a common enemy. After the war, it's no longer have a common enemy. You become enemy for all a special reason. So the thing that, in a way, broke up this friendship was because, you know, the colony woke up to the fact that we can kick the ass of the British. We had the capability, we had the organizational skill, and we could do it. And the reason and the main kind of inspiration, if you like, it came from the fact that Japanese showed it to us, we could do it. Because this is part of the culture of empire. They make them make sure you feel very humble, you feel very incompetent. Unless we stay up there to rule this world on your behalf, you can't get your acts together. So I think that is part of the most important legacy of the Japanese War and the early days of the anti-colonial struggle, that the whole self-confidence became to develop. And I think so. This is also a tragedy that, you know, that the Malayan leadership, Tungku and company, really didn't go and put on a uniform, go and fight in the jungle in a way. So they were never ideologically kind of committed to something. They were committed to get independence, but the only independence they're capable of imagining is the British gift to them on the platter. I mean, this is exactly what happened. There's no insult to Tungku, but this is exactly what happened. So the whole situation of the international scene have changed so rapidly so that the war has meant quite different things in 1948, you know.
It's a very violent war from both sides.
Yeah.
The cover image that you've chosen for your book, which we will upload online to accompany the podcast. It's a very violent one as well. What's the story behind this?
If you go to Google Image, there are a lot of pictures of the emergency. Some of them are very well known, and some of them are owned by Time Life magazine. And Time Life magazine wanted to charge me $500 per image. So I picked up something that's, you know, I can't find where they came from, so I just put it in the top. The story, of course, I like this one more than the Time Life one, so I'm not unhappy to have lost it. Because it's a multiracial team, the Chinese, the British in the front, and the Malay troops at the back, you know, with the Malay policemen. And the carrying of the dead body, you know, at the early days, of course, to identify people, because they had to set up the chart, you know, to interrogation, they work out exactly, you know, who is who, you know, you can do that. And if you want to know how it is done, you go back to watch Battle of Algiers, the interrogation, the torture of prisoner. So once they set up a map of individual, so each enemy you kill had to slot into the individual. So you know, oh, this one has been killed off. So in the early days, when you kill someone like that in the jungle, what is the most efficient way to get an identity? Is to cut the hard head off, you know? So I had a picture there. In the early days, to bring the head back for identification caused such a controversy. Oh, by the way, the controversy was caused not in Malaya, but in Britain, by the British worker, which is the British Communist Party. They launched a protest. So after that, they got this very clumsy way of carrying the whole body to the field. So I suppose I like this picture to show the kind of some of those kind of daily absurdity of fighting a war. You know, how many people are there trying to carry this body? You know, if you had genetic identification these days, you just had kind of make a blood sample or something, you know. But this is the reality of war in those days, yeah.
Like I mentioned earlier, this is a very personal book for you. Could you share the story of your father and then your second cousin?
I try to make this book a little bit more readable, to make it into a more personal book. I try not to make this book into a professor sitting at the podium lecturing down on people. So I thought, since I have this history, why not I bring it in? You know, So my father was a herbalist doctor, Hakka herbalist doctor in Kuala Lumpur. So besides herbal medicine, we also sell the Johnson's bandages. We sell Scott's cod liver oil, the usual brand's essence of chicken, you know, all that kind of imperial products, if you like. So my father, our livelihood came quite a lot from selling those things. Now, during the emergency, my father received a phone call. Someone say, "Oh, would you deliver, you know, 6 boxes of, you know, a box would be a gross, 12 dozen of Johnson's sterilized bandages to Kapong somewhere. We'll wait for you in the coffee shop." So, you know, my father was, you know, I call him a petty bourgeois with a lot of affection, that, you know, the mind was start ticking. This guy never even bargained, you know, just bring it along, we give you cash. So he thought he strike a deal, as it were. So he went, and then this guy turned up, "I'm the one who call you." And according to my father, I interviewed my mother about this. He had covered himself in mud and, you know, obviously he went to the jungle to get out here. But when you are so, my point about the story is that he was so dazzled by the prospect of cash, he didn't even notice any unusual sign of this man. But then my father would probably say, well, he's probably a foreman in the rubber plantation or something. Well, anyway, to cut the story short, when he got home, the special branch were waiting for him, because he thought, well, we're going to charge you for aiding the enemy, which is in those days was a kind of almost a very serious offense. But he has quite a, you know, kind of position in the Chinese community. So
chairman of the Hakka
Association. So he's ended up spending one day in jail. Now, picture the great shame for anyone in those, you know, even now. So he was literally, you know, shut in the jail with a bunch of other beggars and rapists or whatever they were. And that was my father's story about the emergency, yeah.
And your second cousin?
as I dug deeply into my family, I kind of, you know, went around visited some of my old, you know, that we Hakka people call in relative, 亲戚. Actually, we Hakka people are very kind of cluey in the sense that to build up their numbers, you know, Hakka people, especially Taibu Hakka, are very small number in Kuala Lumpur. And all over the world, they're very small number. To build up the number, we tend to create what anthropologists call fictitious kinship. So anyone who's, you know, he's your uncle. For a long time, I realized so many of people I call my uncle were not really my uncle. They were just my father's close friends who came from the village somewhere. So we have one of those aunties that became very close, and they had a farm in Cameron Highlands. And this boy used to work for my father. This is like helping relatives. So he set up, you know, he had an apprentice shop in herbal medicine. The whole idea was he learned enough. This is a petty bourgeois, you know, kind of dream that maybe one day he set up a shop in Cameron Highland. And that is as far as a success story would sustain itself. But he was very unhappy. Now, when we were, when he was living with us, I was like, you know, 6, 7 years old. So I worship him a little bit because he was the one who was very dreamy, who always had story to tell me about why the world was round and not flat. So I would heard, and he helped me to do my stamp collection. So later on, he just vanished. You know, he just got lost, couldn't find him anywhere. And then he went back to his father in the Cameron Highlands, and then he got lost again. He had a story of wandering around, and I remember in school, I saw him, what they call, chuchikarata, you know, car washing in a car park, and then he just looked at me and I looked back. So I lost, that's the loss of this boy. But one day, I came back from school, and my mother was crying, his mother was crying, and I realized that he was killed on one of his midnight visit to his family. The Gurkhas are waiting for him. You know, 3 machine guns opened up on him, on his body. So I'm kind of a little bit kind of sharp having the family who was a guerrilla, because I always thought my family was very safe. You know, very you study accountancy, you rest the world, be okay, don't worry about anything else. And here was like the world, the violin was intruded on my family. So even the petty bourgeois home is never home anymore after the event.
In the end, after writing this book, what is the legacy of the emergency?
I suppose in a way you ask me, what's the legacy? I'm going to say that in cultural sense, in our national consciousness, the legacy is because there's no legacy. You know, we do not remember it. We do, you know, I have a story there about Lee Kuan Yew. You know, Lee Kuan Yew had this, but before he died, loved to play the statesman, going down lecture on people. Sometimes it's a Vietnamese delegation. And I always said, because I was part of the university at that time, I always thought, you know, here's the people who beat the French in Dien Bien Phu. Now I want to learn from Lee Kuan Yew how to run shoe factories or run a beer factory. The whole irony is only lost, not to me, but a lot of other people. So we never take on the legacy of the emergency. Not seriously, we only take on the fact that why do we British need our sponsorship? Why do we keep on telling the good story about the British success in Malaya? I mean, I'm sure my people told me, you know, email, WhatsApp me, or you know, Su Chau, better go and watch this History Channel about the emergency. I seen it before because it's all about how heroic the British were, the Malayan people were, but nothing about the communists. You know, so they were the losers, as it were. I'm not saying that we should somehow worship these as heroes, but we had to account for a certain part of history, and we should be sad. We miss out a lot, I think, for not participating in that history, the making of that history, a making of the narrative that reflect ourselves. I think that is because it's an incredible story to have participated in that struggle. And, you know, I mean, at this moment, at this time, the whole thing is, my sense of disillusionment is that because I'm middle class, academic middle class, I travel a lot, And in Singapore, the young people, my generation would say, oh, I say, where are you going for holiday? I'll say, I'm going to Southern Thailand, spend a few months. Oh, I'm going to London to go shopping. Okay, the whole idea of London shopping, you know, you have named Winifred Wong, you know, I mean, Winifred, it's a kind of ridiculous name. But on the other hand, you have the people telling me, I love to sleep with a quilt in Singapore flat and turn the air condition so cold so that I can be felt like England. So I have that story and plus story about British India. You know, to call a fashion shop and go and shop in British India, it's a bit like shopping in a boutique Holocaust or boutique Dachau. Ideologically, it is the same. So we never developed this kind of consciousness so that when we study post-colonial study or in the university, we study the Indian. Why don't we study Malaya? But of course they can't because Malaysian academic had not really shown an example how to address and how to relive that kind of history with certain kind of radical vision, if you like. And I think it's a little bit, sad. I think that is a much richer heritage of our country, of our Malaysian nation, than Malacca or there's a European history, Portuguese and even Hun Tua was a bit certain kind of construction, the guerrilla war was, we can have our, better of our jeers as well.
Can I ask you just one final question about this idea that the history is written by the victors? In many ways, this war was fought because of economical reasons, right? They needed the tin and rubber, so to speak. How did the Commonwealth soldiers or the forces, the police, feel about defending imperial greed?
I mean, don't forget, 1948 or in the early 50s, the war was just finished in 1944. It was barely yesterday, a few years ago. And the Second World War is a very clear good war in a way. And I, in spite of all my anti-British sentiment, I think it's a good war because if Nazi Germany, occupy England or occupy Japan, occupy all of China, the Holocaust policy, the genocidal policy would be carried out to the extreme, to kill off, 80% of Chinese people, it's not an inconceivable idea. So the kind of morality of war, whether even a pacifist, is not unreasonable for you to support the war, I think. But in 1948, the things have changed. The soldier usually follow order. They don't really care that much. But nonetheless, 1948, they fought for the war. They fought for a new life, not only to defeat the Japanese or the Germans. They want to say, we sacrificed so much, and Churchill promised them, you people are going to have a new life. And so it's a war that fought for us as much as to fought against the enemy, to eliminate the enemy. And so there's a kind of new consciousness among the soldiers. Of course, they are professional soldiers that follow order. And in the Second World War was like mass mobilization. Everyone went to war. Whether in the Malayan emergency, in the post-colonial war, in the colonial war, is national servicemen. National servicemen are young people, 17 to 18, who, forcibly take up arms and drill. And they found themselves in this horrible place in the jungle, spent 3 days. So there were no heroic story anymore in the emergency. Of course, as you know, the famous novel that described all these virgin soldiers by Leslie Thomas, so at the end of the day, all they want is go to the prostitute, Juicy Lucy, the leading carrier woman, and drink tiger beer. And that was their motivation of the war. So there were no kind of concern about morality. So they don't hate communists so much as they hate having to put in a place, having to endure the hardship. And the Commonwealth troops, there were not much of a record of Australian young people, but Australia didn't have national service in those days. So it's a professional soldier fighting on it. And then there are Fijian soldiers and Nigerian soldiers. I hope the Malaysian people realize that it's a war that involves Africans, involves Fijians, Australians. It's a, you know, kind of, and all the colonial lackey, if you like, you know. So the morale has always been a problem, I think. So it's hard to reconstruct all the colonial war, not only in Malaysia, like in Kenya and Cyprus. There were no Dunkirk. There were no real fight to the, you know, last man and all that. There were no heroic narrative going on. So that's the sad thing about Malaysia. We all picked up that little bit of heroic narrative the British trying to give us for our ingestion, our digestion. There were none of that. So the British soldiers were very cynical. You know, they weren't really sure about all this. Now, of course, when you go and interview some Malaysian special branch officer in their 80s, which I have done, and then they come up with all this about how heroic we were and how nasty the communists were, there's not much of a kind of gray area in all this. But of course, we can't expect these two people, you know, these older retired veterans to be objective, to be detached about their younger life. It's pretty heroic, you know. I interview a commander, you know, commander of a special branch. Their job was to hunt in a helicopter. He's a very distinct looking, handsome man. Looked like Rock Hudson, you know. Looked like Jude Law actually, with a Sten gun, a submachine gun. And he said, "These are my Malay troops. They are my friend. I will give my life for them. They will give my life for me." So he had, again, is a very romantic vision of the nation that he feel hugely disappointed that this comradeship between built up in those jungle warfare didn't realize in reality. Yeah.
The book is called The Malayan Emergency, Essays on a Small Distant War. Dr. Su Choyal, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.